Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Hooney Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Andrew Talks to Chefs. I'm your host, Andrew Friedman.
And I'm Caitlin Friedman. Is that what I'm supposed to do?
We're just cracking up because it's like our third take. We haven't managed to get past this. Like, I feel like Stanley Kubrick. Like, we haven't gotten past this point, but we're just going to power through now.
But I do know my name, Caitlin Friedman.
Yes, but you usually don't introduce yourself.
True that.
Anyway, this is Andrew Talks to Chefs. Our guest this week is Dan Kluger of Loring Place Restaurant in New York City. And a lot of people may know Dan from his prior restaurant where he was collaborating with Jean-Georges Van Gerichten. But Dan was really the executive chef of ABC Kitchen, which was known for its very vegetable-forward food. You're nodding enthusiastically.
I did. I loved his menu. I love all those vegetables. I love the space.
Yeah.
His sensibility is great.
That space was kind of a... Would you call it it was kind of a feminine, ABC restaurants, like ABC V, which is the really vegetarian now,
yeah,
the Truly one. It looks a little like Anthropology. It has that kind of
it's
sensibility.
It's kind of girly.
It's a little girly.
Yeah.
But the food was phenomenal. And Dan now has Loring Place. And Dan also, we're sitting here in our living room in Hastings on Hudson, New York, which is about 32 minutes by express train from Grand Central Station, about 18 miles from Midtown Manhattan. And Dan is one of these chefs who lives up in the burbs near us now. Jonathan Benno lives near us, the former chef of Per Se and Lincoln. And Ivan Orkin of Ivan Ramen lives one village over from us. And Dan lives up here, and he came by the house and did the interview right where we're sitting here.
Wait, what do you mean he did the interview here?
Didn't I tell you that?
No, I thought you guys met at the restaurant. He was here.
He was right at this table.
Oh, my God. Did you clean? Did you clean up?
I swear to God, did I not tell you that? It was on Instagram. There was a picture.
Well
you don't
busy.
Go on Instagram.
I'm busy. Wow, he was here? That's so embarrassing.
Yeah, he was right here.
Okay.
Well, it's only embarrassing for me if a chef comes over, if they see, go in our refrigerator or...
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, he didn't go in our fridge.
All right, well, still. Yeah. Okay, thanks for telling me.
Anyway, the interview was conducted here. It's a wonderful interview. I think we'll keep the intro short this week as penance for last 2 weeks. I do want to mention, though, if you all go to my blog, Tokeland, which is tokeland.com, TOQUELAND.com, there is a feature there called Clocking Out, which ran last Friday. And one of the things I talked about was this movie, Knife Skills, which is nominated for Best Documentary Short. It's an amazingly moving film about a restaurant that was opened a couple of years ago in Cleveland, Ohio, staffed entirely by ex-cons, front of the house and back of the house. It's a combination restaurant hospitality school. They trained all these people in record time, and the guy who started the restaurant is himself someone who had done time, and I guess you could say wanted to pay it forward. And just before we recorded this intro, I got an email from one of the producers, because I've heard from these guys, because I wrote this love letter to them on my blog. And finally, this thing is not in theatrical wide release yet, but it is now available on iTunes. And I would highly recommend, I think it's $2.99 to download this 40-minute short documentary that is nominated for Best Documentary Short. Again, it's called Knife Skills. It will move you. It will crack you up in a few very well-chosen places. If you are someone who's in the industry, which I know a lot of our listeners are, I just can't recommend it highly enough. I think it really, at a time when the industry, rightfully for the people involved, is being criticized, this is a reminder of how many good people there are in the industry, and I think a reminder of how generous and special this business can be, because it does give a lot of people a home who have nowhere else where they function well. This is something we've talked about with a number of guests, most recently Curtis Stone, who did the Chrysalis program at his restaurant in Los Angeles. So that's all I'll say about that. But I highly recommend Knife Skills, available on iTunes now. And with that, I think I'm going to simply introduce Dan Kluger and the interview that we taped. To your chagrin, I cleaned up.
I believe you. I'm also so proud that we kept this intro so short.
Yeah, but well, let's stop there though. Let's not start patting ourselves on the back.
Because we could talk about how short we kept it for a really long time.
All right, with that, everybody, here is my interview with Chef Dan Kluger, recorded right here in my home, our home, to my wife's everlasting dismay. I hope you enjoy it. So, first of all, I've never done an interview in my home.
I thought this is how you normally do it.
No, and I think you and I have only met once. I don't even know if you remember. A million years ago, I was at a it was some benefit. I don't even remember what it was for. And I was there with Alfred Portale.
Yeah.
And I introduced myself to you as his collaborator, and you fixed a little pasta for me and said, you know, take this over to Alfred. I don't know if you remember that.
God, I can't remember.
Yeah, it was I can't even remember where it was. It was some random event. Huh. Anyway. But I think that's the only time we've met.
Maybe it was a Star Chefs thing.
Could
years
have been
ago.
Something like that. Yeah. So it was on the second floor of some space. You were sort of in the far corner of the room.
Yep. I think it's the only time I've ever done a pasta. That's how
okay. It was definitely, it was delicious. My portion was smaller than his. I had a non-VIP portion before I introduced myself. So, Dan, first of all, we're sitting up here in Westchester. This is always surreal to me. There's a lot of chefs who were migrating up here, but professionally are staying put in the city. What's it like for you to have a commute of this nature?
You know, I think the commute can really suck.
Uh-huh.
At the same token, even living in Brooklyn, you know, the train was 45 minutes.
Yes, and that was where you were most recently.
Yeah, okay. Before this was Brooklyn, Park Slope, and I loved it.
Yeah.
And I loved, you know, in reality, how close it was to the city. I mean, 7 miles at most.
Right.
But if I did drive in for some reason, it was still 45 minutes.
Yes.
And the train was 35, 45 minutes, sometimes more, depending on what was going on.
Yeah.
And what I've found with this is I can make phone calls on the way in.
Yeah.
I make phone calls on the way home sometimes, much later at night. Coming home is very easy.
Yes.
I got into Audible books, and I've been like reading books that I never would have read before in my life. So I've actually really kind of started to enjoy the commute, as tough as it can be.
Right. You make use of that time in a way that you didn't have time to make use of
exactly,
before.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, really making use of the time and especially coming home, as tired as you can be, it's like pulling into that driveway and I'm in a sanctuary. You know,
right.
I mean,
really,
I have essentially one neighbor by me and I have plenty of room and it's slowly becoming a sanctuary.
Yeah. So I find your career very interesting because not to, you know, spoiler alert, I don't know, but you, you know, most of your career, not every minute of it, and your life has been New York City. I mean, you're a real New Yorker, you're a New York cook, your life has really played out about 18 miles south of where you and I are sitting right now, give or take.
Yeah.
What was your childhood like in New York? What part of the city did you grow up in, and what was that like for you?
I grew up on the Upper West Side,
uh-huh.
In a huge complex of buildings that you know, kind of in some respects was, I guess, the equivalent to a gated community. You know, uh-huh. We had backyards and play areas and things like that.
Backyards, like sort of a courtyard, like between the buildings or the towers. Yeah. Right. So it was sort of like an enclave.
Yeah. I mean, basically this set of buildings is 66th to 70th Street on the west side.
Okay.
And so there was literally 66th to 69th backyard.
Wow.
You know, I mean, almost three blocks long.
Rare thing in New York for people who don't know New York.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I'd go to another friend's house, you know, 10 blocks away that didn't have it. I was like, well, do we go to Riverside Park? Right. Go to Central Park? You know, I didn't do that as much because I had this backyard.
Yeah.
Went to a very small school on the Upper West Side, graduated with, I think, 14 other people.
Wow.
So totally different than I think... you know, certainly that my kids are growing up with.
You had a very unique New York experience.
Yeah, I think so.
What kind of kid were you? Were you a jock? Were you were you a good student?
And I was average student. Yeah. You know, kind of just an average kid.
Yeah.
And at a young age, I think I started to be interested in baking more so than cooking. Mm-hmm. My mom did a lot of baking. My father loved to cook. Our friends opened a bakery on the Upper West Side. And
oh, really?
I mean, at probably 8 or 9 years old, I would go on the weekends and bake cookies and croissants and things like that. And it certainly wasn't like this love. I wasn't, you know, saying this is what I want to do with my life. Mm-hmm. But I got used to that labor, you know, being in a kitchen. And again, you know, always sat down to a home cooked meal.
Yeah.
I didn't really grow up going out to eat.
So restaurants weren't a feature of your
life. Not much.
And food was.
Food was. But again, not, I don't think we were sitting down to, filet mignon and prime rib and things. It was more London broil and popovers.
Yeah.
But you know, everything was made from scratch.
Yeah.
Not bags of frozen peas and things like that.
So you were sort of conditioned for a certain level of, I guess, integrity, quality.
I think so.
And maybe you didn't call it that, but you just sort of, that was your baseline.
I think just more this idea of, you know, nothing coming from a package.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Yeah.
My parents definitely, again, they were both into cooking, and I know they did some crazy dinner parties where they would, you know, do a whole bunch of stuff from something of the lines of Escoffier. I mean, like crazy French food. Mm-hmm.
Were they travelers? Did you guys take culinary trips or anything like that?
No. My mom's from England, and so we certainly spent a lot of time over there. And my father was in the army and traveled when he was in the army. But again, I don't think he never would have said, well, you know, the best Wiener Schnitzel in Germany was this or the best.
Right.
There's nothing like that.
But
I think, you know, he exposed himself to a lot of those kind of things.
So what did you originally think you were going to do with yourself professionally? Like when you were growing up, what was sort of your sense of where you were headed?
You know, I'm not really sure. I had at one point thought about things like architecture and engineering. I was always into, you know, fiddling around with building things, electrical things.
Yeah.
If a lamp was broken in the house, we fixed it.
Right.
If the remote control car stopped working, I took it apart and got it working again.
Really?
So I was always very into those kind of things.
Yeah.
And I went off to Syracuse and... thought maybe I would do, again, maybe architecture, then realized that program was too much and didn't want to do it.
Too much because it was like really intense. Consuming it was?
Yeah.
I sort of tried to date an architecture student when I was in college, and it lasted about 10 minutes because she was always in the lab.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like those people are in their own world.
Yeah, I ended up with a roommate, I think, my junior year. We had a house together and she was an architecture student and I was working with her on a project, which we'll probably talk about later. And I was like, this is crazy. I could have never done this.
Yeah.
So I was into the idea of that faded away quickly. Long story short, I started to think about, physical therapy. I was very into
really?
That.
What was the appeal of physical therapy?
So the part of my childhood and part of my life that I never really think that much about was I was a gymnast from 6 years old all the way through college. Went to scholarship. Went to Syracuse on scholarship.
Gymnast, like parallel bars and all that stuff. Yeah. Really? Yeah.
You know, now that I'm like 100 pounds heavier, I've kind of forgotten all of that. But because of that, I was always at training camps and things like that. And I was always intrigued by physical therapy and obviously the football program, lacrosse program, basketball at Syracuse was incredible. And I spent a lot of time in the training room with those guys and really kind of was drawn to it. But they don't have an undergraduate program. They have a graduate program, which is, again, is exceptional. So I don't know if it was an advisor or whoever said, oh, well, you should become a nutrition major.
Yeah.
Or that was one of the directions. Because you'll take nutrition, anatomy and physiology, chemistry, all these things that are prerequisites to become part of the graduate program. So I took the started taking some of these classes and took nutrition, which was very interesting. Took a food science class, which I loved, which was like cooking / the science of everything.
Yeah.
And I just started to take a few more classes as I went in this program and really kind of started to become intrigued by it. And then somebody said, well, you should maybe consider the restaurant management program. I'm not going to get into restaurants. No, that doesn't make sense.
And now management, they were thinking front of the house.
Front of the house. And so it wasn't a Cornell style program. It was certainly a degree that you could get was restaurant management, hospitality. I think they were.
But it was sort of like nuts and bolts. You mean?
Yeah. And certainly, I think it was good, but it wasn't of the caliber of Cornell.
Sure.
But one of the professors who was actually a graduate of Cornell, who was like the hardcore, hard ass professor that everybody was afraid of.
Yes.
I took one of his classes and I was like, this guy's actually pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to take the next class, which everybody's like, you're going to fail.
Yeah.
Everybody fails. Yeah. No reason. And of course, I all of a sudden went from being like a C student to an A student and I, you know, aced his class. And then we became very friendly and I started to get very involved in extracurricular things through this program.
Yeah.
But I was still very intrigued by the nutrition and so sort of created my own major where it was a dual in nutrition and food service management.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a very amazing character, Leon Jeanette, who his first wife, I think, had passed away, and his children went to Syracuse as well, and he had the Jeanette Auditorium.
Okay.
And through the Jeanette Auditorium, he had a lecture series, and it was retail and hospitality aligned. So Tommy Hilfiger, the CEO of Macy's, the CEO of Bed Bath & Beyond, Charlie Palmer, David Boulay, I'm trying to think who else, but the main person that was important for me was Danny Meyer.
Mm-hmm.
And so Leon said, we always did a lunch for the guest.
Yes, sure.
So Leon said, I want you to sit with Danny. I got to work it. I'm a student. He said, no, we're going to make you sit.
Now, at that point, what year are we, can I ask?
That would have been my junior year.
So what year, 1993? Okay, so
around there.
That is right around when Gramercy was about to open.
I think they had, maybe it was 94, I think they had just opened.
Just opened. So Danny was already a huge 10 years in the bag on Union Square, which was a revolutionary restaurant in its own way, mostly for the hospitality, but also for the food.
Yeah.
And about to open what some people thought would maybe, it ended up not being a 4-star restaurant, but very famously there was a cover of New York Magazine that had 4 stars because that was the anticipation that maybe this was going to be the American 4-star restaurant that hadn't happened yet.
Yeah.
So that's, he was, you were aware of him.
Yeah, totally aware of him. Yeah. Obviously not of the level that I think anybody living in New York and dining out would have been.
Sure.
I was obviously secluded in Syracuse, and certainly not of the level that anybody today would be aware of.
Yeah.
But it was very exciting, and I was excited to have the opportunity to sit with him and talk to him. And I showed him around the campus, and had a very nice time with him. Took him over to the Carrier Dome, which was the huge stadium, and walked in and welcomed Danny Meyer in lights, which kind of blew his mind. And he's obviously a sports fanatic, so I think it was a fun thing. Anyway, followed up with him to do a summer internship. So that summer I went to Union Square Cafe. His managing partner, this guy, Paul Bolsbevin, amazing. And started that, I guess, 94, 95, somewhere in there.
But not in a kitchen capacity.
Not in a kitchen.
I spent
a couple days in the kitchen just as an intern, see what was going on. But I was doing, you know, inventory stuff, host, you know, reservations, some accounting, like very just, they were great about showing me all sorts of different things.
You don't seem like a front of house guy to me. It doesn't seem to me like that's where you would flourish. Did you enjoy doing that?
I did. And it's funny that you say that, because I actually, after I graduated, I went back to work in the front of the house at Union Square Cafe.
Uh-huh. And you enjoyed that?
I did enjoy it. But, you know, they said, essentially, you know, be a host, probably maitre d', whatever it is. You're going to work for a year and a half, and then we'll look at maybe making you a manager.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, something really kind of stood out as, well, I went to school for management. If I'm not doing anything with this degree,
right,
and I got to wait a year and a half to 2 years and maybe become a manager, what's the point?
Yeah.
But I was very content being a host. I enjoyed it. I actually do. I find myself very much involved in the front of the house, and mm-hmm. I understand what's going on.
Yeah.
And I take that part of the hospitality very importantly in terms of my business.
And you enjoyed talking to guests, and that was all comfortable for you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, certainly as a young kid, it was harder, but I enjoyed, you know, that Danny mentality of really trying to take care of people and make them feel very comforting, comforted, was important to me. And you know, even at a young age, it was. I remember somebody coming in and saying something about, you know, having to go out to feed the meter. Could they get some quarters or whatever? So where's your car? I'll go feed the meter for you. Like, that was a Danny thing.
Yes.
I'll go buy a newspaper for you. And I want the same thing from my staff today.
Yeah. It's hard for people today to understand, because there are people now who have made such a study of what hospitality is and taken it to the next level, how revolutionary that was in some ways.
It was very genuine.
When they started doing that. Yeah, genuine, but also what a big deal that was and how special it made people feel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, there were friends that I made through that, you know, became amazing people in my life because of this quick one-off relationship.
Yeah.
And I'd see them, you know, years later.
Yeah.
They would come to the next restaurant and so on and so forth. So I started in the front of the house, and I was going along that journey to kind of see what would happen. But I knew that probably even if I became a manager, and I wasn't sure if that's what I wanted to do, at some point I wanted to own a restaurant. I knew that was what I think I was starting to get that bug. I wanted to own something. I wanted to create something.
How early on did you start to think like that?
I think, honestly, through that senior year. Yeah. We had to do a project, and that's what I was saying about the architecture roommate. We had to do a project where we created a restaurant.
Yeah.
Much like you do at CIA.
Yeah.
But ours was very much about, less about the food and very much about numbers and all the operational things, and even design, because we'd done some design stuff. So I had helped my roommate with a project she did, and now she's helped me with mine, and we really did architectural drawings for this restaurant.
So you, like, knocked it out of the park?
Yeah, I mean, we had to go find a space, a real space.
Uh-huh.
It didn't have to be for sale or for rent, but we had to find a space that would work.
For the purposes of being able to show people what you envision doing with it, with renderings or sketches or whatever. Yep. That's great.
And so we created this thing, and it was called the Crossings, and it was in a railroad house.
Uh-huh. Now, what was the food going to be like at this restaurant that you created before you had decided to be a chef? Was there any sort of prescience there?
It was very 1995.
Okay.
I mean, it was, you know, Bobby Flay meets Union Square Cafe meets Oriole meets, I mean, it was everything that I was, like, starting to get acquainted to through this process.
Okay.
And it was, you know, the red pepper coulis and
right.
You look at the menu and it's literally 1995.
Something two ways or something. Yeah.
Definitely two ways.
Some kind of meat two ways.
Dots. Right. Flourless chocolate cake with raspberry coulis.
Blue cornmeal.
Yeah. And then when we finished the project, we actually had to present it and cook the food and everything.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I can picture today the flourless chocolate cake with the raspberry coulis with, I think, chocolate sauce as, like, a checkerboard.
Wow.
And I mean, what did I know?
Yeah.
So I knew that or I believed at that time that I would want to open a restaurant. I would want to own something. And so I said to myself, as I was working at Union Square Cafe, I should learn a little bit about the kitchen. Mm-hmm. I should understand what's going on so I know what the chef is talking about when I hire a chef.
Right.
And so I started spending some days off in the kitchen. And within a few weeks, I really started to catch this bug of, this is pretty cool back here. I like it.
What drew you to it?
I think the pace, again, as I said earlier, I always liked working my hands. I always liked being creative.
Yeah.
And so while I wasn't fixing something, I was making something. And I mean, you know, they had me just doing basic stuff. I was helping make prep stuff.
Yeah.
It was very basic, but I enjoyed it.
But even that you enjoyed.
I enjoyed
it. You didn't mind the repetition.
No, no.
There's a phrase that comes up so often in interviews I've done with chefs that when they talk about when they were younger, I loved working with my hands. Mm. That exact phrasing. What do you even have an insight into what that is for people? It's amazing. I'm sure you've talked about it with other people who cook. I mean, it's amazing how often that exact phrase comes up.
Yeah. I don't know. I think obviously there's a level of creativity.
Yeah.
I think, you know, a lot of chefs are going to have the creative gene. They're going to have this bug for being busy.
Yes.
They have the interest in kind of working,
yeah,
heavy lifting, sweating, all of, yeah, those kind of things.
Yeah.
I don't know why it's so common. I mean, yeah. I mean, at a young age, I was building things.
Yeah.
When I got my first apartment, I built a wine rack, mm-hmm, you know, and I mean, all these things were crappy, but it wasn't to a level of being really proud of it.
You
but
couldn't
I got
sell
to,
it.
No, but
right.
I got to
But you got the satisfaction
something.
Of doing, yeah, it.
And now today, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I love owning a home. I'm constantly building things.
Are you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I just finished building built-in bookshelves for,
yeah,
all the cookbooks,
right,
and building a desk and making,
yeah,
an office.
Yeah.
And I mean, I like that.
Making stuff.
Yeah, I like seeing something start to finish. And,
right.
And again, I think, and it shows very much with the food, is I think our food is meant to be good, flavorful, fun, simple.
Yes.
There is a very simple level of finesse.
Yeah.
And I look at the things I build, and it's sort of the same thing. Like, it's not... You know, I don't have the best equipment. I'm not making the best cuts, and everything,
right,
might be a little bit off. It's just like I could never last in a kitchen where, you know, everything has to be brunoised, and,
mm-hmm,
and you know, if the cut isn't perfect, or if I haven't cooked something absolutely perfectly,
yeah,
I'm out the door.
Right.
I wouldn't have lasted like that.
Nor would
I'm,
you want to. It sounds like
no.
Like that's who you are.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I think all of this just kind of has become a common pattern.
That's very interesting. Now, what about, before we kind of lose it, yeah, too far in the rearview mirror, the gymnast thing, do you, it seems to me that there are correlations between that, mm-hmm, and cooking. Did you ever connect anything, or am I being too precious about it? I mean, it's physical, first of all,
physical,
obviously.
Discipline, hard work.
But it's also in its own way expressive.
Expressive, repetitive.
Yeah.
You don't learn to do the next thing until you perfect the first thing.
Yeah.
Right. So, and again, I think I was never the best at X, Y, and Z, but I was always really good.
Right.
And so, I had certain skills that I was very good at. But maybe the other side of that skill I wasn't good at.
Mm-hmm.
And so sort of the same thing with the food.
Right.
Like there's certain things I think I'm very good at.
Right.
And yet I wouldn't hold a candle to some of these amazing chefs out there that are way more creative and involved and know, you know, tons more than I do.
Right.
I mean, I watch some of these kids today and it's like, it's amazing.
Kids in kitchens. You don't mean like kids on TV. You mean like younger cooks. No,
I mean like the new up and coming,
yeah,
chefs.
Yeah. 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 But you seem very, I mean, you're saying this almost in a self-deprecating way, but you seem, I mean, there's all kinds of ways to be a chef, right? And there's all kinds of styles of food.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, until what, 20 years? I mean, who in Italy would be any different from what you're describing yourself as?
Yeah. I mean, right? Yeah. I'm not looking to reinvent the wheel in anything I do.
Yeah.
I'm literally, and this is, I think, the funny part that you'd said, I don't seem like a front of the house guy. I'm more concerned with just making people happy.
Right.
And if it's the food or the experience or the wine, I don't really care.
Yeah.
I want them all to be good, but I don't really care what blew somebody's mind or what made them happy.
Yeah.
You know, I got a text from a customer the other day that lives upstairs, and they came in and had a great meal and decided to email us to tell us that. And I wrote back saying, it's awesome. Here's my number.
Right.
Feel free to reach out.
Yeah.
And he wrote back saying, we're actually sitting at the bar again tonight because it was so good.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, made his comments about how people were taking care of him, et cetera. And it's just, that's what I want.
Yeah.
I don't, the awards, the recognition is less important today than just making people happy and filling a restaurant. And
yes.
Employing, you know, a number of people
several
that need
dozen
jobs.
People. Yeah. Yeah. What, it's interesting though, like what you just said, it also seems to me, certainly when you were coming up, that seems to me like a distinctly East Coast distinction you were making between someone who could do the perfect Brunoise and someone who has no interest. I mean, if you'd come up in the Bay Area, would that have even been something that you would think of? Probably not. Probably not. I mean, it's such a technique-focused community here, I think. I mean, always.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
Anyway, so how did you, having already gone to school, how did you pursue cooking? Getting better at just, forget getting to a point where you could create on your own, but just the fundamentals, the craft.
So spent my time off in the kitchen just learning a little bit. And at one point, Mike Romano said, you know, do you want a job in the kitchen?
Yeah. For people who don't know, Mike Romano used to be, for years, he was the second chef at the Union Square Cafe and was there for forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's who you were working in the kitchen there for.
Exactly. Yeah. And so he offered me this job, and I was a prep cook, making $8.90 an hour.
Uh-huh.
Working with fully Spanish crew, and I didn't speak one word of Spanish.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a little bit now kind of like a jump from where I was before. I was like working next to a sous chef, doing some prep projects, helping a cook out, learning a little bit. And now I'm just peeling potatoes and slicing the chips and cutting calamari. So all of a sudden I started to now sort of second guess it. Like, is this the right thing for me? I mean, I went to college, to learn to run restaurants, not to slice potatoes.
Yeah.
But I, at the same token, I really enjoyed the physical labor of it. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed what I was learning. And within 3 or 4 months, I think it was, he offered me a different kind of prep position where then I was making some of the fresh pastas.
Okay.
Which I started to fall in love with.
Yeah.
And really started to see the benefits of creating, learning a skill and using that skill to create something day in and day out, and really look at it and say, my ravioli isn't as good as the other guys, and I'm taking too long and things like that. And so
you were able to analyze yourself in that way, evaluate. Yeah. You were able to kind of see yourself from the outside and recognize what needed work.
Yeah,
in a clinical way.
And certainly, if I wasn't, somebody else was pointing it out.
Maybe in a less clinical way.
Yeah. But no, they were, you know, I it's amazing. I look back and so quickly I moved up.
Yeah.
And I moved from one station to the next.
Yeah.
And I look back at this crew and I can think about these guys I was cooking next to, guys and girls, Juliet Pope, who I worked with on pasta, and she became, you know, the wine master at Gramercy Tavern. I worked next to this guy, Terry Hardwood, who at that time had just been an executive chef and decided to take a break and just line cook.
Yeah.
I worked next to another guy who, Chris DeLuna, who's now one of the executive chefs for restaurant associates, running a number of their restaurants. Yeah. And again, he had been a sous chef, but decided to take a step back and just line cook. I worked with Scott Frantangelo, who owns a restaurant in Ardsley, who's owned a couple of restaurants now. And I mean, this crew was amazing. Yeah. And they were also, as much as they were happy to beat me up, they were also generous with the knowledge and and the time. And I mean, there was certainly stuff back then that wouldn't fly today in a HR perspective of, you know, yelling at each other.
Right.
And they were certainly, you know, times when it was obvious that they would sort of say, you suck, you need a lot of work.
Right.
But they were also happy to build me up and
they could see that you were trying. They were willing to invest in you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I owe a lot to those guys and the sous chefs at that time. Kenny Callahan, who then became the chef of Blue Smoke, opened Blue Smoke.
It's amazing.
There were a number of incredible people back then. So started working my way up in the kitchen. Spent about 2.5 years there. And still questioned, was this the path?
Yeah.
What did I want to do? And right around that time, Floyd Cardoz was on board, getting ready to open Tabla. Mm-hmm. And he was working at a Union Square Cafe's kitchen, doing recipe testing. And
Tabla was going to be an Indian restaurant.
Indian-inspired American restaurant.
Okay, sorry. but that was a two-level, two-floor restaurant. Yeah. The upstairs was sort of more fine dining, or, you know, and the downstairs.
Upstairs was really the American version. It was that Indian inspired American food. It was, you know, Floyd had worked with Greg Kuntz at L'Espinasse, and it was this you know, very high end, fine level dining with all this Indian inspiration.
Right, coursed out.
Yep.
And then downstairs was what they called the bread bar, and that was more casual. And that was one of the first places I ever remember going where they said the food comes out as it's ready from the kitchen. Mm-hmm. It might be the first restaurant at that level that I remember hearing that.
Yeah.
Anyway. So that was Tabla.
That was Tabla. And so Floyd was doing some recipe testing and kind of much like anybody in this situation, helping out in Union Square.
Yeah.
And I remember kind of hitting it off with him early on, became very friendly and without, you know, poaching me by any means, when the time was ready for Tabla to open, he said, I'd love for you to come with me. And I went over to Tabla, in September of, I don't know, probably 1998, I think it was. It was right before we opened.
Yeah.
And we were supposed to open then, and it got delayed, I think probably 2 months. And it gave me an opportunity to do more recipe testing with them and be the only cook that they had hired at that time. Mm. So it was me and all the sous chefs and Floyd, and really, like, you know, educational experience. And being the young cook, watching all these guys put these dishes together and get ready to open a restaurant was inspiring. Like, now I think I really had the bug. I was like, all right, forget all the other things.
You know, it's interesting to me because I would think that, please tell me if I'm wrong, but it would seem to me that you had this background, you know, you were kind of interested in things that would fall under the umbrella of like engineering. Mm-hmm. You like to put things together and take them apart. You did this project in school where you kind of designed, you know, a fictional restaurant. Mm-hmm. You come into Union Square Cafe at a time where it's already an institution, right? But then with Floyd, you're actually seeing something, you just said, you know, coming together, being created. You're watching it go through the assembly line process. Mm-hmm. It would seem to me that this would sort of take restaurants to a different place for you mentally. Does that make sense? That seeing a thing come together would appeal to you in a way that maybe it hadn't quite before. Seeing dishes be created instead of, like, let's see, iconic tuna burger on the lunch menu. That's been there forever, and now I'm cooking it, and that's satisfying, but maybe it doesn't turn me on the way something would have to happen for me to be that interested. Does this make sense? Is this accurate?
Yeah, I think this really started the need for me to know as much as possible about the restaurant. Meaning, when I was a host at Union Square, I started to get exposed to things that were going on in the whole restaurant.
Yeah.
When I started as a prep cook, I then started to learn everything from the ground up.
Yeah.
So when I was a line cook and somebody new came in, I was the guy that knew where the hot water heater was. I was the guy that knew where the light switches were. I was the guy that knew how to cut the calamari and where it was. The new cook didn't. And so I started to get really excited about that knowledge. Mm-hmm. So then at Tabla, again, it was like I knew where the panels were. I knew where the shutoffs were.
Yeah.
I had seen this thing. I mean, I literally walked in. I don't know if you remember the documentary that they did on Danny. And they show a phase of construction where it's like, scaffolding and everything. And I walked in and to meet with Floyd, I had to go in through 11 Messon Park, up a set of scaffolding, literally through a tower of scaffolding, into the private dining of 11 Messon Park, through the back hallway, over into Tabla, down the stairs to meet with him.
Right.
I mean, that was like the maze. Yeah. And so
it's like walking through a schematic.
Exactly. But it was really fun that then when the place was open, it's like, well, I saw all of this come together.
Yeah.
And so I think that while I still questioned everything that I was doing, I think it definitely started to firm up the need to create something from start to finish.
Yeah.
Both in the food, but more in terms of the restaurant.
Yeah.
So I worked my way through the line at Tabla, went downstairs to the bread bar, and I remember, bread bar food was great. It really had a great feel to it, great vibe. But for me, it was like I wanted something a little different. And I remember talking with Floyd and kept talking about Chinese food and that sense of family style, sharing, it comes as it's ready.
Yeah.
Really kind of like authentic, good, flavorful food.
Yeah.
And again, the bread bar had been really amazing in terms of everything they were producing. And it was definitely more Indian than upstairs.
Yeah.
But I felt like we were missing something. And, I know he felt the same way. And as we started working on things, I think things transformed a little bit more to the menu it had become at the end, which was this really authentic. This was a place to get all the food that Floyd grew up with.
Yeah.
And his mom made and his wife made. And it wasn't a variation of it.
Yeah.
It wasn't a modernized variation. It was the actual, street food dish from Bombay, but using American ingredients, using farm ingredients, Union Square Farmers Market ingredients, maybe toning it down, maybe making it just slightly Americanized so it was a little more approachable, that kind of thing. And so now all of a sudden I was learning this whole new style of food, this culture. And, his wife would come in and we'd be talking about something and I would go to him the next day and say, can we make this? Or I would go to his house for, he'd do these Memorial Day picnics. And, and again, it was very authentic.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that needs to go on the menu tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I started to really get excited by that part of the food.
Uh-huh.
Because I've never, and it's the one thing I think in my career in general that I'm missing is culture playing a part in the food. So, for example, Jean-Georges obviously has incredible Alsatian culture, French food, German food, that he brings to the table. Danielle, same thing.
Right.
Mario Batali.
Yeah.
I mean, incredible Italian culture.
Yeah.
Eric Rapaire. I mean, you name it, right?
Yeah.
All these guys, incredible culture that they can apply to the food.
Mm-hmm.
It could be their grandmother's favorite meatballs. It could be, I remember Floyd making this dish that was endive wrapped in ham. Not Floyd, sorry. I remember Jean-Georges making this dish that was endive wrapped in ham, baked in bechamel sauce.
Right.
And we had it on the menu when we opened ABC. And this was something he grew up with.
Yeah.
I really have that. I have, lemon chicken, whatever it was. I mean, I had very basic stuff.
Yeah.
And so I really started to latch onto this idea of the Indian culture playing a part in the food. And so it just helped motivate me. And it was really an exciting time. And I worked my way up there. I spent 7 years there.
Yeah, you rose all the way up to chef de cuisine, yeah?
Yeah, so...
It's interesting. You, by virtue of being with that company and being so close to the, you mentioned the market at Union Square, the farmer's market there, it really seems like that, you know, it's funny. Who knows what chef you might have become if you had started in Midtown, you know? It's really interesting. It really seems like those two jobs, you know, the place of vegetables in Indian cuisine, and the place of the market in both those restaurants, really coming along when you were literally learning your craft. I mean, yeah. It would seem to me like those things are, it's almost like a double helix. Like those things are very intertwined in your development. Yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, you almost didn't have a choice in the matter.
I don't think I really had a choice, and I constantly look at it as, you know, people say it's not luck and stuff like that. I was lucky.
Yeah.
I mean, had I not met Danny, right. You know, the movie Sliding Doors.
Yeah, right.
I love that analogy of, you know, if she didn't get on the train or she did get on the train, and I shudder to think what I would be doing today.
Yeah.
If I hadn't met Leon Jeanette, if I hadn't met Danny, if I hadn't gotten that, if I hadn't ended up at Tabla, if I mean, and even the negative things that happened through my career or my life, they luckily have put me to the next path. Yeah,
you know, it's so funny. I used to have a job in public relations. I was trying to be a screenwriter, and I hated doing public relations. But I happened to work for the best restaurant PR firm in the country years ago, a guy named David Kratz, who's not in the business anymore. We represented everybody. One of my clients was Alfred Portale. Mm-hmm. I ended up writing the Gotham book as a one-off because we had a great relationship. That became my career. My wife worked at that agency. So that's how I met my wife, right? Even though I hated PR. I mean, I was just there for the, literally just there for the paycheck. Mm-hmm. And didn't know anything about restaurants before that job, you know? And it's amazing.
It is amazing. You know, I shudder to think where I would be today if those things didn't work. Yeah. And I look at so many people and almost sort of feel bad. Have they been able to have that same experience?
Yes.
You know, I mean, I met my wife through Tabla.
There you go. It's amazing. You
know, if I didn't work at Tabla, who knows where I would be.
But don't you feel like, I feel like half of it is that luck piece, but I think the other half of it is having the ability to recognize those moments, to recognize, right? I mean, there's stuff happening to us every day.
Yeah.
To kind of go, oh, this kind of is interesting to me. Maybe I'll pursue this. I think a lot of people just, they're so on this kind of preordained path, you know, that they don't stop. They don't recognize that sort of pull, you know, that maybe would spin their life in another direction.
Yeah. And I credit my parents, especially my father, to a lot of those decisions.
They encouraged it.
They encouraged it, but also I relied on them, or I respected their opinion.
Sure.
And, you know, I would go and say, hey, these are my two options right now. What do you think? And I obviously it was always my decision, but I think my father was always good about helping me think things through.
Yes.
You know, at one point, so I think I guess somewhere around mid Tabla.
Yeah.
I met with Richard Corain, who was one of Danny's partners, and we talked about, you know, was it time for me to move on? And there were a few different opportunities, and I don't remember exactly when it was, but there were a few different opportunities, and I wasn't 100% happy at that point in time. Didn't know exactly where I wanted to go, but for whatever reason, I ended up sticking with Tabla.
Yeah.
And you know, spent my time there. It was time to move on. And Floyd happened to bump into Colicchio in the street, Tom Colicchio.
Yeah.
Literally bumped into him in the street, and my name came up, and Tom said, oh, tell him to come see me. And went to go see Tom, literally, like, you know, probably the next day.
Yeah.
Tom said, I got something going on with witchcraft. I got, forget what the other thing was.
Yes.
And I got this job at a private club. I don't know if it's your kind of thing. And we talked through it. And it seemed really exciting. And it was this private club in Midtown called the Court Club.
I'm going to do a perfect to be continued right there. Because that's probably something I told you when we sat down. I had never heard of the Court Club before I was getting ready to talk to you. So let's do a quick break.
Sure.
And when we come back, we'll get into that. And then we have to get to the two restaurants most people know you from.
Yeah.
ABC, and Loring Place, of course, which is your current restaurant. We are talking with Chef Dan Kluger of New York City's Loring Place. We're talking in Westchester County in my dining room. And before we go to break, I do want to remind people, if you would like to follow the show, we are on Instagram and Twitter at Chef Podcast is the handle. That's at Chef Podcast. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher. And if you'd like to leave us a rating, which is quick, or a review, which is a little more time consuming, but I'd love you for it. It does help people find the show, and we'd really appreciate it. And we'll be right back after this break. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a tiny bride, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night. My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel, Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
And we are back with Chef Dan Kluger of Loring Place Restaurant in New York City. So, Dan, we kind of abruptly stopped when you introduced the Core Club. Mm-hmm. What was the Core Club?
So the Core Club was a private membership club in Midtown, founded by this woman, Jenny Saunders.
Okay.
She had this idea to do this membership club and really sort of the best of the best. Mm-hmm. And, you know, very high net worth members. But I think for me, one of the things that I think was really interesting about the way she positioned it and created it was there was a lot of cultural programming based around the club.
You mean speakers and things like speakers, that? Guest authors. And
they had the connections. So yeah. When it was time for the Oscars, right before the Oscars, they would start screening. They had a huge screening room. They'd start screening all the movies that were being nominated.
Amazing.
And bring the directors in to talk about them.
To what size audience? This sounds like it was probably 50, intimate.
50, yeah. 60 people.
Amazing.
So she was, I mean, she's an amazing, driven, crazy, frenetic person who I really hit it off with.
Uh-huh.
You know, we would be texting each other at 2 o'clock in the morning about things to do at the club. I opened it, much like we talked about before, being able to see something built, start to finish. I wasn't involved with the design of it.
Yeah.
I was involved with the design of the kitchen. I was, that was basically done, but Tom and I kind of worked through some things. I bought everything for it, really did as much as I could sort of at that point in time in terms of designing something. And I really was excited by the project. And so I think her passion for the project and my passion were just feeding off each other.
Was there a style of cuisine there, or did it change based on who was there in a given day? And, I mean, it sounds like a fairly, sounds like a customer base that's probably used to getting what they want. But was there a set menu? Was there like a kind of a base menu that you helped conceptualize and have in place? What was that like?
So I think it was a set menu, and, you know, Tom and I were very aligned in that we wanted it to not be a country club. And we didn't. We wanted to stick to seasonality, farmers as much as possible, being very product related, much like Kraft was at the time.
Yeah.
Kraft Bar, Gramercy even.
Yeah. You guys seem very, I never thought of this before because I didn't know you'd had this job.
Yeah.
But you guys seem super compatible to me from a culinary
viewpoint. So. I think, you know, if I, especially when I think back, you know, I worked at Union Square and Tabla, you got a monthly dining allowance to go eat at one of the restaurants in the group.
Yeah.
I forget what we called it. But I mean, I think in my 10 years in the company, I ate at Gramercy Tavern 50, 60 times.
Really?
More than any other restaurant.
Did
in my
you
life.
Eat more in the tavern room or more in the main dining room?
Both. But probably almost equal.
Uh-huh.
And I think back to some of those meals in the main dining room and that approach to food, and I can remember things like, you know, roasted scallops with a little bit of vanilla and salsify and sauterne, and I think about how he coerced the flavors, but very simply.
Yes.
This pork belly with just a little bit of mustard. And I mean, just so many things I can remember.
Yeah.
And they were just so, like, you know, sort of in your face, this is the flavor.
Yes.
Eat it and move on.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it. And I think that definitely, and then the little bit of time that I spent with him, because he basically helped open it, and then he was consulting on it and kind of moved away within the first year.
Yeah.
His contract was up.
Yeah.
But I think that time with him, I spent time at Gramercy, I spent some time at Kraft, much like Floyd did when he was at Union Square Cafe.
Yeah.
And so I think that time there really helped open my eyes to some other techniques and some other ways of again, coercing flavor out of ingredients.
But it seemed to me like am I right to think that this would be sort of the pivot point for you from a creative standpoint, and that you started to understand who you were going to be as a chef?
Yeah. So this it forced me to create a menu on paper.
Yes.
And really think about ingredients I liked and things I wanted. And you know, I started with looking in some of my favorite books, Alfred Portal's book.
Oh, thank you very much.
I remember it laid out on the
first one.
Yep.
The Gotham book.
Yep. Thanks. I remember it laid out in the in my dining room on my dining room table, along with a whole bunch of other ones, and thinking about things like what spoke to me, what inspired me.
Yeah.
So I created this menu, and you know, it was breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yes.
So it was a big change.
Yeah.
But it was about trying to make really good, simple, like best of the best kind of food.
Yeah.
And catering to this group of people that, much like you said, are used to getting what they want. And the menu definitely modified itself to meet some of that.
Yeah.
But we really set out to create great food in a restaurant that wanted to be a restaurant, not a country club.
Right.
So I think it's certainly over the 4.5 years I think I was there, it certainly took some inspiration from things that members wanted.
Yeah.
You know, I remember kind of fighting the turkey club sandwich and the chef salad and things like that. But then realizing, okay, you know, what's wrong with it? I mean, a turkey club sandwich is pretty damn good. So let's just make the best one we can.
Yeah.
So we bought the turkey, roasted ourselves, you know, yada, yada, yada.
And that becomes satisfying in its own way. You know, it's funny, but you mentioned the burger, the Gotham rather, you know, I was going to say famously, but probably it's only famous to me and Alfred. But when they opened the Gotham was open a year before Alfred came in, and Jerry Kretschmer felt like one of the owners felt like you had to have a burger in New York, right, on the lunch menu. And Alfred did not want to do it. And eventually it was on the menu as Jerry's Burger. But Alfred came to the same revelation. He said, well, you know what? This was before everyone had a burger on the menu. This is, you know, in the 80s.
Yep.
And you didn't come from stodging in France and want to have a burger on your menu. But he did the same. He sourced the tomato and he's the lettuce and the beef. And it was one of the first, like, high-end burgers. And then it became, oh, that's fine. Yep. Okay, fine.
Yeah, I'd say same thing. I mean, fought the idea of a burger. And I think even Tom was like, no, we're not putting a burger on the menu. And It's like, all right, well, we got to put a burger on the menu. Like, everybody's asking for it. And yeah. set out to make a great burger, made our own ketchup. I think we found the best bacon we could find and so on and so forth. Yeah. I think we were baking the buns for it. And, right. You know, that was a little bit of like looking back at Union Square Cafe and the lessons that that taught me in terms of just making good, approachable food.
Right.
But I think one of the things that also really helped shape me as a chef was now I was managing a crew.
Yes.
I'd managed a crew at that point for already, I think, 4 or 5 years, but I was managing them in the sense that I had to find everybody myself. I was in a private club that, yeah. you know, it was hard to get people to even walk in the door.
It's not sexy.
Nothing sexy about it. I mean, no. Luckily I was able to pay a dollar more than probably the average restaurant, but yeah. I didn't have you know, Danny Meyer. I didn't have Floyd Cardoz. I didn't have a name.
Yes.
To help. At that point, nobody knew who I was.
Yeah. You guys weren't going to get reviewed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it was definitely a struggle. But I will say, I mean, I ended up finding some amazing people. I really lucked out. I liked the challenge of taking a young green cook and building them up. And Karen Hsu, who's one of my chef's cuisines, and Seth Seligman, who's also one of my chef's cuisines, both worked for me there back
That's
in 2005.
Amazing. That is so great.
They both started as line cooks and worked their way up.
And did they come with you to ABC as well?
They came with me to
That's
ABC.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And there are a few people that you know, I've seen their careers move on, and to think that we just worked in this little private membership club.
Right.
But I think the other thing that really helped me with was... essentially, there was no budget, right? Yes, people were worried about money, but nobody's watching over me like, oh, you're, you know, half a point high on your food cost.
Oh, you mean there was no budget as in there? I thought you meant there wasn't a lot of money to spend. You
no,
meant there
no.
was no there defined was budget.
Yeah, so yeah. I all of a sudden...
We'll let you know when you go over.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
You know, just make sure you're making money.
Yeah.
Which we were.
Yeah.
But I, you know... I made a breakfast menu, a lunch menu, and a dinner menu. I started making hors d'oeuvre menus. I started making special menus for events. I got the ability to, like, you know, buy white truffles and black truffles and do whatever I wanted with them and teach myself about
yes.
how these things worked flavor profile wise with other right. things because I hadn't been exposed to that. I'd yeah. never, I'd never used a truffle really. I mean, right. I think we did maybe 2 dishes at Tabla with black truffles.
Yeah.
But now was the opportunity to do these things
yeah.
and buy, you know, langoustines imported from France and things that I didn't go crazy, but I got the opportunity to see things I hadn't seen.
Yeah.
And so I think that was, as a chef, I was incredibly fortunate because, again, I didn't travel to France. I didn't travel to Italy. I didn't have this culture. I wasn't exposed to classic French food. I didn't work at Le Bernardin.
Yeah.
I didn't work at Danielle.
Yeah.
So... now I was able to start playing with some of these things and some of these techniques that
yes.
they maybe had done
yeah.
that a young cook there got to use. I was teaching myself.
Sure.
And all along I'd been teaching myself.
Sure.
I mean, you brought up Charlie Trotter before. I used to read those books like the Bible. I mean, I'd go home every night and I was reading Charlie Trotter, Charlie Palmer, Alfred Portal. I went through La Russe Gastronomique.
Yeah.
You know, front to back.
Did you really?
Yeah. Escoffier. I mean, I would read these things. I'd go home every yeah. night and read.
It's amazing.
And that's how I learned a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I started to apply these things. I really got to play around for the first time in my career. And yet we were still very adamant that we wouldn't just throw things out to people. You know, you couldn't just make something and put it on a table for
they
somebody.
Were not your guinea pigs. Your
yeah.
customers, you had to yeah. hone something first.
Exactly.
But you had the ability to do new things. You know, it's funny, a lot of chefs I know, I mean, now a lot of people tend to go to it after they've even been chefs, but mm-hmm. At the time you came up, I know for a lot of people that sometimes, you know, private chefing was a gap
yeah.
job.
Yeah.
Tom Valenti, I remember, told me, you know, that one of the most impactful years of his development, maybe 2 years, was when he was a private chef. And the only instruction he was given by the guy he worked for was he didn't want to have the same meal twice,
mm-hmm.
right? So Tom, these things were not perfected the way you
yep.
did them, but he had the ability to sort of screw around,
right.
to try new stuff,
right.
to and it helped him figure out who the hell he was
yeah.
as a chef.
And because people were eating there, I mean, this is a place where people ate lunch, you know, 4 times a week sometimes.
Yes.
And so because of that, I did have to change the menu a lot.
Yeah.
And I think people expected, and I allowed, while again it was very ingredient centric and it was very American in its sense, I allowed the Asian influence, the Indian influence, all these different things because I knew, you know, people wanted variation.
Yeah.
And so I started to really, I think, venture out and define a style, mm-hmm. Which, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about a little more in the new restaurant, but
yeah.
I really got to play and find a voice.
Yes.
And at times I'm sure it was muddled and it was crap.
Yeah.
But
that's part of the process.
It's part of the process.
Growing pains.
Yeah.
How do you define your style? Like, let's transition, because we don't have a ton of time left. Let's transition now to ABC and to Loring Place. Do you define your own style? Or is that something that your PR people have to do?
It's always been just seasonal American,
right?
That's what I've been doing, again, since the time at the Court Club, which is the first time where I can say my style, right?
Uh-huh.
Seasonal American.
Yeah.
You know, Tabla was seasonal Indian-inspired American food.
Right.
Union Square Cafe was seasonal American with an Italian Mediterranean twist, I think you'd probably say.
Yeah.
I mean, if you...
Maybe a sprinkle of California, but yeah.
California, yeah. I mean, there was Asian. I mean, it was a mix.
Yeah.
So I just look at it as seasonal American, but I think now with the new restaurant, it's still seasonal American. I think I've found more focus on things from my childhood or things that have come up through my time cooking in New York that I didn't realize.
So you're talking about Loring Place,
first of all. Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to fast forward over ABCV. But so, ABC Kitchen. But that was when a lot of people, because I didn't go to this private club. That's when I first became aware of you. I remember the first time I went there. And I just remember being blown away.
Yeah.
I just remember being blown away by the sort of the purity of it, by the bigness of the flavor, mm-hmm. by how vivid the flavors were, and by how satisfying so many vegetables could be. I mean, it was one of the places where I really feel like I first had that. There's a lot more restaurants now with that kind of focus mm-hmm. in New York, but... it was a real revelation to me. I loved that restaurant. But how do you, and we should say that was under the auspices of Jean-Georges.
Yeah. I think, you talk about the sliding doors effect.
Right.
I lucked out. I mean, I literally was at the farmer's market while I was working at the Court Club.
Yeah.
And I was at Buried Treasures, and uh-huh. Franca says to me, I'm carrying all this crap, and Franca just happens to say, oh, do you know Jean-Georges?
And
I'm like, yeah, of course I know Jean-Georges, but he doesn't know who I am.
Right.
And so we talked for a quick minute, and I had the introduction, told him who I was, and he had heard of the Court Club because his business partner, Phil Suarez, was a member.
Uh-huh.
And I'd met Phil a couple times, but that really had nothing to do with how I ended up where I ended up.
Yeah.
But we talked for a few minutes, and he, again, kind of said, well, what's your next step? And said, I'm looking for the next right move. Who knows? He said, well, come talk to us. And I called the next day and set up a meeting, and I met with them. His corporate chef was really kind of his right hand.
Is this Dan DelVecchio?
No, Greg Brainin.
Oh,
so Dan DelVecchio ended up hiring me for the Mark Hotel.
Okay.
Greg Brainin was not part of Culinary Concepts, which was the other part of Jean-Georges.
Got it.
But Greg Brainin and I talked first, and he said, we got a couple things. And one was, he didn't say the name, but basically the style was ABC Kitchen.
Yeah.
And then when we kind of started to firm things up, unfortunately ABC Kitchen was not happening at that point in time. And so I ended up going to Culinary Concepts with Dan DelVecchio to open the Mark Hotel, which was delayed. And I got to travel around with Culinary Concepts and Jean-Georges for about a year. And I opened Atlanta, Arizona, Utah, DC, a bunch of restaurants with them. And so I started to see, this process of opening restaurants in a very more organized method than I had seen before.
Sure.
And I got to see a lot in terms of the Jean-Georges operation and how he ran his restaurants, and it was great. And so then the Mark Hotel started to pick up speed, and right when we got room service up and running, ABC Kitchen
came online,
and they said, this really sounds like it's what you want to do. It's very in line with what you do. And I said, yep. And so I moved over, and it was, again, everything happens for a reason, perfect timing. Vong was closing. The chef, Pierre from Vong, came into the Mark as I was leaving. I mean, literally within days, everything worked out.
But, you know, you and I never sat before. You've been very modest in this, you know, the way you talked about, like, your technique and, you know, your comments about, you know, Brunoise earlier in this interview. There are not a lot of people who have worked with Jean-Georges who get the kind of spotlight that you had under him. There must be a reason for that. I mean,
I think
there's other talented people.
There's incredible.
Did you guys just have a great relationship? Did he take a liking to you?
We had a great relationship, and I think it was, I think you said something about the restaurant earlier. I mean, it was right place, right time. You know, just that.
Yeah, but I think I'm not just seriously. I mean, Jean-Georges, I think, is a real gentleman, and I think he's a great guy. And, but, you know, it's usually a Jean-Georges. I mean, how many people listening to this could tell you who was the chef at any number of places? Right. You know, they can't name his chefs, but you were very known at that restaurant. I think you should be, I don't know. I think you should feel very good. I don't know what that was about, but he clearly thought there was something special about you.
I think he was very willing to help promote me in the sense that I think he didn't... he didn't want me to hide. Yeah. I think
you were again, very visible there.
But going back to one of your early comments about the front of the house, I think this speaks to it.
Like, that's interesting.
I looked at this as, and I never looked at it as how do I make this about me, but I looked at it as, you know, if we're going to create a restaurant, let's make the whole experience really great.
Yes.
And so I did want to be involved with the front of the house. And and you know, he would say, go say hello to this person. Mm-hmm. Let me introduce you. And I always did that whether he was there or not. And I think that's part of the reason why, you know, I started to create these relationships and people started to know who I was.
Yeah. It, again, strangely, and I hadn't really thought about it, but just as, you know, you, I think, were very compatible with Colicchio from a culinary standpoint, strangely compatible with Jean-Georges, no?
Yeah.
Because for all of his technique, you know, he's got a 3-star Michelin flagship restaurant, and that implies a lot of technique and precision and all that, you know, where you're sort of more rustic. Mm-hmm. But he also, I've always felt, because of his gift for flavor combinations and surprise, in a good way, not in a weird, wacky way, especially when he first came on the scene and he was doing things that just people hadn't seen, and the way he uses acid, and that there is a fundamental simplicity, I feel like, to a lot of what he does.
Yeah.
And that seems to me to be right in line with what you do. Not exactly the same as what you do, but compatible.
I think very compatible. And I give a lot of that credit back to my time with Floyd. Mm-hmm. You know, this education of balancing sweet, sour, salty, spicy textures. I mean, Floyd was, look at Greg Kuntz's cookbook. It's all about those things. And Floyd was a big part of that.
Right.
So, you know, I think we joked before about Howard Stern, and I'll give you this opening, but
this, by the way, for people during the break, we were talking about Howard Stern's interviewing abilities. Cause I made a comment to Dan that Howard Stern is my interviewing role model. Make of that what you will. I maintain till I go to the grave that Howard Stern is maybe the best interviewer on, certainly in an audible radio podcast setting. Anyway, yes.
You know, the thing that you don't want to talk about is, I think mine is this whole, you know, if you go back and look at the reviews of Loring Place, everything was pretty much, it was just like ABC.
Mm.
Well, of course. And Jean-Georges certainly had his stamp on ABC 100%.
Yeah.
But so did I. I mean, it's part of how I was cooking. It helped shape more of my cooking.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you just brought up the compatibility. I was cooking that way at the Core Club with acid and chilies and you know, hot sauces and things like that. Did my time at ABC help shape more? Of course. But, you know, this seasonal American, this playful, you know, punch you in the face kind of food, but simple.
Yes.
Has always been the way I've cooked.
Yeah.
And maybe at the Core Club, it was more finesse. Maybe it was less finesse. I mean, you could question that, but I think this is the way I've been cooking, and every place I've been has helped shape that.
Yeah.
ABC was incredible in terms of, I think you talked about the simplicity of it, which is really important.
Yeah.
There were dishes that certainly were not simple, but there were dishes that really were as simple as can be. I mean, right. Tuna with a great sauce. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah.
Beets with great yogurt. You know, but the yogurt was something that I wanted to make in-house from day one.
Yeah.
We made yogurt, we made creme fraiche, we made butter. Right. Those were things, you know, I had this whole idea of, you know, how do we go back to the basics, the ABCs? How do we go back to the basics of cooking and jams? I mean, I remember, you go back to the Court Club, I remember having this argument with an unknown, very, very wealthy man who basically told me I was an idiot because I wouldn't serve him, you know, strawberry jam in the middle of winter. And I said, yeah. We don't have strawberry jam. He's like, what do you mean? I said, well, we make the jam in-house, and I have orange marmalade, and I have this. He goes, you make the jam in-house? I said, yeah. He said, why the hell would you do that? I said, because it's better.
Yeah.
And I gave it to him, and he looked at me, he's like, all right, you win.
Right.
I mean, yeah. There's nothing wrong with this.
Because it was like taking a bite of sunshine in the middle of February.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I go back to this is the way I've been cooking for a long time.
So you feel like, just so people understand, when you said I said something about the question, I was telling you that a lot of times I come into interviews and I feel like there's like the big question.
Right.
And
right.
You were saying that what, the unasked big question here, or you're sort of the thing that...
Yeah,
that you saved me the trouble of like probing.
Yeah,
but that you feel a little bit what? You feel like when the reviews happened for Loring Place that you were a little undervalued.
I don't know if I'd say undervalued, but there was a lot of. I mean, Adam Platt's review was pretty much, well, it looks like ABC, it tastes like ABC.
Right.
I mean, you know.
Where to you, it's more of there's this sort of
there's a similarity.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny. I tried for 10 minutes once to learn guitar, and the instructor made this analogy that, you know, a song, a good song, the writing, a well-written song, it was like following an arrow to a bullseye, right? And I feel like that's what a chef's career is like, right? So you're like, you had there was this arrow that got pulled back in the bow. That was, you know, Union Square and Tabla, and then the Core Club, and then through Jean Georges, and like you're kind of getting, maybe you're at the bullseye now with Loring Place, which is finally, you know, your ambition of having your own place.
Yeah.
There you are.
And ultimately, like I said, all I really want is for people to be happy.
Right.
So if the bullseye is creating things that are similar to what I've done in the past,
right,
wherever it's been.
Yeah.
And those things worked, again, wherever they were,
yeah,
then I want to do that.
Well, this is the catch-22, right? Yeah. Everyone's saying that they're kind of had it. This is this moment in time where people are sort of over the ego-driven chef. Mm-hmm. And right, and you're almost, you know, like what you're saying basically is you feel like you're a little bit penalized for not being more of an, what did Alan Richman call it in that article years ago? Egotarian cuisine, right? You don't practice that.
Yeah.
And you said a minute ago, it's as simple as it can be. And I've always thought that I've never been a chef or a professional cook, but, you know, as a diner and as someone who's thought about these things a lot, I feel like once you have a clear idea of a dish, it's kind of like writing. Mm-hmm. That idea should be executed in the most simple way possible.
Yeah.
Beyond that, why? You know, so like when you say something with a great sauce or beets with, you know, the yogurt or... That's a dish I happen to remember pretty vividly, you know. Right. That's, I mean, what more do you need? It's funny. You know, I coined this term amongst friends of mine a couple of years ago. Somebody, gosh, it might have been Adam. You know, they were doing their list of the best restaurants, and they said something like, you know, they were talking about per se, and they said like, oh, you know, the salmon cones again and the so-and-so again. And I coined this term, food writer problem. That's how many people are like, oh, per se again?
Yeah.
How many people have been to per se once? How many people could afford to go to per se once? I mean, I'm fortunate. I've been there a couple of times.
Yeah.
I can write it off. Maybe not anymore, but I used to be able to write it off before the new tax plan. But, yeah, I totally am with you. So we only have a couple of minutes here, but what's for you, you made a reference to this new element that you feel like has come into your food at Loring Place, drawing on childhood stuff. So what's this latest evolution in your style?
You know, I think I struggled for it to not be ABC, right? I didn't want it to just be considered ABC. And to me, ABC started to become an adjective. I mean, people would say, oh, that restaurant's like ABC.
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of like ABC.
Yeah.
So I didn't want it
to be... Which is a compliment.
Which is an incredible compliment to them and obviously to my time there.
Yeah.
which I'm grateful for. So I really struggle with, well, if I'm doing seasonal American food and I want to do wood burning and I want to have pizzas and things, how do I make them different? And so through the whole process and through designing this, you know, again, I got my, this was jackpot. I designed every single thing. I mean, I got to choose every piece of wood, every paint color, every nut and bolt. I mean, we ripped this thing out. And so I was finally getting to do everything I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so when I started to get back into thinking about the food, which was really kind of a struggle because I'd been out for a while, and I wasn't feeling incredibly inspired at that point in time, I started to think about what are these things, and my father had passed away during the process, mm-hmm. and I think it just kind of made me, I don't know what the right word is, it's kind of cliche-ish, but almost like homesick, right? Yeah. Like I missed my father, I missed my family dinners, I missed, all of a sudden I was like missing childhood. Like it made me think about all these things.
Sure.
And again, we didn't have culture really. And while we would go out to eat from time to time, my father certainly wasn't like, oh, the best dumpling place is whatever, or the best, the best steakhouse or the best popover or whatever. There wasn't any of that. It was like, let's just go out for this. And so I really started to think back to things that inspired me through my childhood, and you certainly see it a lot in the dessert menu.
Like what?
The we have a cupcake that's play on a Hostess cupcake. We have a
was something you ate as a kid.
As a kid, I mean, like mm-hmm. without a doubt, we have a sundae that is a play on a Dairy Queen Blizzard, which again was like
Blizzard
a treat.
Now you're talking my language.
We have a box of cookies, which again, I mean, we had cookies all the time. My mom was baking cookies. We had tins of cookies, all sorts of different kinds. Yeah. And so all those things started to play a part. And so I was able to do it really easily with the dessert menu. And then I started thinking about the rest of it. And I really just started to say, okay, well, I didn't have that culture. I didn't have that, you know, that upbringing where we were going out to eat. And I can remember the first time I ever had duck or whatever it was. So I started to think more about, well, I've been cooking these things. I've been working in restaurants now for 15, 20 years. I've only worked in New York. What has been inspiring about New York? And what has been inspiring about these restaurants? And I really started to pull things from that. And, you know, we have a crispy cauliflower dish, which started as this thing that I remember, a cauliflower puree that Floyd had done with a piece of fish. And it was nothing like this, but it just, I thought cauliflower and I thought Floyd and I thought about some spices I like. And then I thought about how would I turn that into a dish? And it became a dish of spiced, Indian spiced crispy cauliflower with lemon. And by no means is it Indian, but it's this play on things that were exciting to me back then.
Was there for you, it's funny because you're saying these things, right? It sounds to me like this was the equivalent, like you talked about feeling like there was something missing at Bread Bar,
mm-hmm.
right? And then going to Floyd's mm-hmm. home and like, right? And then this personal connection happened. And that's like this amazing sort of alchemy, which, you know, people in the dining room can never know, but it affects the way this food is cooked, right? Mm-hmm. Clearly, just even the way you're talking about it, these new things that have come together for you, and some of it for painful reasons, at Loring Place, there's this new layer there now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you were at ABC Kitchen, for all the accolade and success and everything else, mm-hmm. and for as much as, so I'm sitting in the dining room loving it.
Mm-hmm.
Are you in the kitchen in view of me when I'm eating there? Were you there sensing there was something missing? Or was it something that you only perceive now in hindsight, that there was another gear?
No, I don't.
Does that make sense? Like, this thing that you now have that you weren't really having, that didn't really exist for you before in the food,
mm-hmm.
Did you feel that as some kind of a longing or some kind of a deficiency personally? Or this is just to you part of evolving and getting deeper as a chef?
No, I think what inspired me at ABC was just different things. It was of the time. It was certainly the food we were doing there. If it was time to replace beans with squash, it was, okay, what fits for this restaurant? What fits within the model of what we were doing? And then it was feeding off of Jean-Georges and Greg. I mean, it was do you like this dish? No. Do we need to change it? You know, whatever it was.
Yeah.
There's nothing missing. And if you were watching me from the dining room, I was extremely excited about all the food
you
we were doing.
You seemed really happy back there.
I was.
Yeah.
I would have been just as elated about you liking the dish that was 100% Jean-Georges, the 100% right. Greg, or the 100% me. Yeah. Ultimately, it was a team effort.
It's not an ego thing for
no.
you.
Now...
You're on the wrong coast.
Now it's all about how do I make it relatable? How do I...
Right.
Sort of how do I tell a story? Like, again, you know, when I read those reviews and somebody wants to say something like, oh, it's just he's using jalapenos just like they did there. I was using jalapenos before.
Right.
So what is my story to tell? What is exciting to me? And what drives the food? And so I've looked back. Mm-hmm. I mean, the duck, I want it to be approachable. I want everything to be, and that's something I've really learned, I think, through the years. And I think Jean-Georges really hit on it was, look, yeah, change the menu seasonally, but let's not constantly gut the menu because people are going to find things they like.
Yeah.
And so... You know, duck is seasonally available. We found a great source for it. So I wanted to do something with duck, and I thought back to all the different places, and I thought back to things we did at Tabla. And so I've kind of like put it a little bit of an approach of how we cook it that way, but I'm using the wood-burning grill. And then I thought back to Union Square and the duck, which was cooked, you know, all the way through, and it was a totally different product, but always had like a great seasonal chutney.
Yeah.
And I love that sweet, sour, fatty, and all those things that spoke to what I was doing. So, you know, I started to apply that to things.
Yeah.
I'm not making the chutney I made at Union Square. I'm not making the one I made at Tabla, but those things have inspired those decisions today.
Well,
and that's what it should be. I mean,
food is autobiography, isn't it? At some level.
But it's also about learning. I mean, I don't know how I watch some people come out of, you know, culinary school or not even culinary school. They cook for a year and all of a sudden they're a chef running a restaurant. Some of them are geniuses. It's amazing. But I think part of it is the journey.
Living,
and you can do the journey by going to Italy or going to France or going to Spain or wherever it is and obviously benefit from that.
Of course.
You can do the journey by working at 12 different restaurants.
Yes.
I did my journey by putting in a lot of time at only a few restaurants, but really like sucking them dry for as much knowledge as I can. And you know, I'm constantly saying to cooks when I interview them, I say, you know, I expect a year commitment from you.
Yeah.
And I do that because I want a little return on our investment.
Totally.
But also I want you to see how one restaurant, one chef works with a season, you know, a
full year.
Year's seasonal ingredients.
Yeah.
And ultimately I really think you should do more than a year because I look back and I think about how, you know, I saw how Mike Romano, yes, some things were recycled, but some things were completely different. And he had a new inspiration. He'd just come back from Italy, and he had a new inspiration for how to use fava beans. And I got to see how one chef used something twice.
Well, or I don't know if this is true of Michael, but at some point, you know, okay, now it's time. It's spring again. We're going to put this on the menu. And maybe just like a slight tweak to one element of it. But it refines it. You know, Ridley Scott's made like, there's like 8 director's cuts of Blade Runner out there. I think that's what dishes are like. It's much less expensive with dishes.
Yeah.
But I feel like chefs have that opportunity. Like every year is the director's cut if they want it to be.
And I think a young cook can really learn a lot from that.
Sure.
I think, you know, seeing how one person sees through this dish, you know.
And taking something from good to great to maybe...
That much better.
Greater, you know, just like a hair greater.
Yeah.
Great. Well, it's been great talking to you.
You too.
Thank you for coming to my house. And we have obviously been talking with Chef Dan Kluger. Dan's restaurant is Loring Place in New York City. If you enjoyed his food before at ABC Kitchen, you will enjoy the newest evolution of his food at Loring Place. And if you did not enjoy it there, you should go discover it. He's a great chef. And you will remember the flavors for a long time. Dan, thanks again.
Thank you.
Great to see you. And that's our show. A big thanks to Dan Kluger for dropping by our humble abode in Hastings on Hudson, New York.
Dan, it was great to spend some time with you and get the rest of your story. Obviously, I didn't know a lot of that stuff. And a reminder that if you would like to follow the show, we are at Chef Podcast on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can also follow me personally at Tokeland Andrew. And if you'd like to leave us a review or a rating at Apple's iTunes store, we would appreciate it. And a reminder, my new book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, How Food Lovers, Free Spirits, Misfits, and Wanderers Created a New American Profession, publishes just about 4 weeks from today on February 27th. It is currently available for pre-order. It's about the chefs of the 70s and 80s and how they created the chef profession in the United States, and I hope you'll check that out. Thanks for listening, and look forward to seeing you back here next week on Andrew Talks to Chefs.